You may have heard of genes that act selfishly, organisms that adapt in order to survive, ecosystems that behave as cohesive units. Biologists often talk about these things as though they were purposeful, exhibiting some kind of agency, directionality, or function. Should they? That's the big question that brings together the experimentalists, theoreticians, and philosophers who are involved in the Biological Purpose Project. This is the Purpose Podcast, where we will hear different interpretations of agency, directionality, and function, and how people use these interpretations to solve some long-standing questions in biology and tackle real-world problems. Welcome to episode 4. I'm Siddhant. For this episode, I spoke to David Odeberg, a philosopher based at the University of Reading who is affiliated with the Biological Purpose Project. Because I happened to be in London in December of last year, I took a 45-minute train ride out of the city to Reading.
I guess it's quite empty now.
Yeah, I mean, the term is finished. Was it last week? And yeah. People kind of wander off. I mean, there are still people around, but they kind of wander off, and a lot of grading, end-of-term grading that people are doing, so they kind of go off and hide away and mark their assignments and stuff like that. And just some people are just kind of getting ready for Christmas.
David leads a project called Mistakes in Living Systems. The goal of this project is to come up with a theory of how biological systems fail. You don't really have to be a philosopher or a biologist to know that living things make mistakes. I mean, animals making mistakes makes up a large portion of the internet. But David thinks taking mundane everyday things very, very seriously is part of the job of a philosopher.
My favorite definition, if someone said to me, what is philosophy? What's your definition of philosophy? My favorite definition was actually told to me by a fellow undergraduate because I grew up in Australia and did my undergraduate studies in philosophy in Australia. It was a fellow student of mine, and I don't know where he got it from. I've never been able to trace the origin, but he said to me once, philosophy is what everything else becomes when you think about it hard enough. And I've always taken that to heart, that you can pick anything. You can pick, you know, my laptop. You can pick the chair that I'm sitting on. You can pick the person I'm talking to. You can pick a speck of dust on the floor, and you can literally philosophize about it. If you think about these things in an abstract, highly conceptual way, you can start to make connections between so many different things and find common patterns and common ways of understanding to help you kind of get a grip on the world and everything that's in it. So that's how I got into philosophy as such.
And so you said it started off when in your teens, because your family's full of philosophers.
No, my family's not full of philosophers at all. My mother and father didn't seem to have any interest in philosophy whatsoever. In fact, they didn't even go to university. It's actually my brother, he did a little bit of philosophy when he was doing his law degree. I also did a law degree back in Australia, and he did a law degree, and he did some philosophy, combined degree with humanities where he did some philosophy. And I remember him coming back and talking to me about, you know, John Stuart Mill and Descartes and different things like that. And he used to kind of wear t-shirts that had philosophy slogans on them. And that kind of got me intrigued. And I started looking at encyclopedias, and occasionally I'd pick things up on TV programs. Funnily enough, Monty Python's Flying Circus, which will be familiar to some listeners, a classic of 1970s British comedy when I was growing up, had members of that who studied philosophy in one form or another at Oxford or Cambridge and did some famous sketches on philosophy. And funnily enough, watching Monty Python, which I really loved as a teenager, also helped get me into philosophy, because there was a lot of philosophical content in their comedy sketches. So, you know, once you pick that up, you just go with it for the rest of your life.
That's really interesting. So like, humor was a big draw for you.
Yeah, because the surreal. Because Monty Python, if you've watched Monty Python, you know that it's very surrealistic. It's hyper surrealistic, and philosophy is a discipline that encourages you to think about different things in different ways, not in the run of the mill way, but you kind of analyze things from a different perspective. You know, you'll ask questions that you would never ask if you were just sort of sitting down in an office job, but, you know, balancing the accounts. You know, you wouldn't ask, how do I know what a number is? Are these numbers real? What is mathematics anyway? What is mathematics the same as logic? How do I know if mathematical reasoning is reliable? Maybe God is deceiving me. Maybe 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. Maybe it equals 5. Now, if you're balancing the books for a big tech company, you'd be fired if you started asking your CEO those kinds of questions. But as a philosopher, that's what we get paid to do. We get paid to ask questions like, you know, what is a number? What is mathematical knowledge? How do I know that my senses are reliable, that I'm looking at I'm looking at someone who's talking to me right now, or maybe it's an illusion, you know, and you get into all these weird skeptical things, and it can get very surrealistic. And, you know, you can, if you're a philosopher with a bit of common sense as well, as I hope I do, you have a grounded kind of sense of reality as well. You have a sense of humor, and you can look at these questions and ask crazy questions as well, and you can see them as quite surreal. So, yeah, there is a connection between philosophy and humor. There's no doubt about it.
Before having this chat, I watched a lot of videos of David's public lectures on the internet, and I was hoping to come up with some questions so we could have an insightful conversation. Instead, I started with this.
And I think, I mean, thinking about like mistakes in biology seems a bit, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, your reaction is the same reaction as we've had from various people, both in philosophy and biology. And I think one of the reasons that we were successful with the grant, because it was a kind of, you know, with our application in the first place, was it was asking questions that maybe typical biologists won't normally ask, or maybe they think of them, but they don't ask them in the same way that we were asking them. So, you know, mistakes. You think when you make a mistake, well, think about the mistakes you make in your life. I make a mistake by arriving too late for my appointment. I forget to look at the clock. I forgot to hand in my assignment if I'm one of my students. I didn't submit that paper by the deadline. I played the wrong card in a game of bridge. I tried to move my bishop in the wrong way in a game of chess. Now, those are mistakes, right? Someone say, you've made a mistake. Don't do it like that. Do it like this. And we can all understand that basic kind of human concept of a mistake. A mistake is a thing that humans make when they forget what to do, when they misplace something, when they misidentify something, when they ignore someone that they're supposed to be talking to or ignore something they're supposed to be doing. We can understand human mistakes. And human mistakes involve consciousness and awareness, because even if you don't realize that you forgot to look at the clock, someone will remind you, hey, you missed your appointment. That was a mistake. And you think, yeah, I know, I should have done that. And you feel responsible. You feel accountable. Or you might say, hey, it was just a mistake. It wasn't such a big deal. I didn't do it deliberately. Or you might say, oh, it was a mistake. You know, I'm so sorry. I won't do it again. Please forgive me. And this is how we train children. We educate and correct my own children, you know, point out when they're making a mistake and point out when they're doing the right thing. We try to get them to do the right thing. Now, the interesting question we asked ourselves as a team was, well, look, it's not just humans who make mistakes. Animals make mistakes, right? So the classic example of, you know, the dog forgets where it buried the bone, right? I mean, I've never actually seen a dog bury a bone. I've never seen a dog fetch a bone. But, you know, it's folklore. And surely, you know, wild dogs and coyotes and wolves and foxes bury food all the time. And you can imagine that a wolf or a dog might forget where it buried its prey. If it just doesn't remember where to go, that can happen. Animals get lost all the time. They don't have an infallible sense of location any more than humans do. Think of other mistakes. So, for example, one that I like is it's a little video clip that I use in presentations of a frog sitting on a leaf or a twig trying to catch an insect. And it leaps out. It, you know, does one of its typical frog jumps to get the insect, but it's just a little bit too late. And the insect flies off. It just misses. Now, that frog has made a mistake. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. Maybe it hasn't made a mistake. Maybe, you know, it didn't realize that the insect was so quick. Maybe it judged everything as well as any frog could possibly do. But the insect flew away. Well, yes, but it would still count as a mistake. Now, why is that? What we think is that it's wrong to think that organisms that make mistakes all have to be thinking in the way humans do, because they don't, because they're not human. So, you know, there are some higher mammals maybe that have a kind of sense of self-awareness, but the kind of unique self-awareness that humans have is not replicated even among gorillas and chimpanzees and other and orangutans. So don't expect a dog that forgot where it buried the prey, or a frog that didn't manage to catch the insect. Don't expect them to think to themselves, oh, I've just made a mistake. I better be quicker next time, or I better pay attention to where I buried the bone. They just have these instincts. They have a suite of a repertoire of behaviors and instincts that are kind of hardwired into them that give them a general sense of where to go, what to do, and when to do it. And usually they get it right, because if they don't usually get it right, they end up dead. So they usually get it right, and occasionally they get it wrong. And obviously species that always get it wrong end up extinct pretty quickly, right? So don't expect there to be that kind of self-awareness that we have, let alone, you know, responsibility. It's not like the frog is going to say to itself, I'm such a bad frog for missing that, or I'm a really good frog, I did the best I could, but it was just bad luck. No animal thinks like that. But we need to strip that away. I think that that's a higher level conception of mistakes, which belongs to the human realm, which is extremely interesting when we think about, you know, mental disorder and cognitive malfunction. And that's all very interesting. But animals have a kind of lower level of mistake making. And we actually think that this kind of mistake making can be found all the way down even to the cellular level, not just
which is
frogs.
Which is what you're studying.
Which is one of the things that we're studying. So not just frogs or dogs or wolves or birds, which is another thing we're interested in, but maybe even cells, maybe even blood cells, maybe even platelets that are involved in the blood clotting process. So, for example, you know, our main focus within our team is on blood because we have a world expert on the blood clotting system and a postdoc who's working on modeling of blood clotting. And so what we do typically is we'll sit down with John, our blood clotting expert and our postdoc, and we'll say, well, look, here's a question that we asked very early on. Blood clotting is initiated by exposure to an injury. So you cut yourself, as you well know, your blood starts to clot. Why does it start to clot? Why doesn't nothing happen? Why don't you just bleed to death? Well, because there are platelets and other, you know, proteins and so on, that, and cells and proteins that are involved in, kind of, as it were, plugging that hole. An injury is a hole in your endothelium, the lining of the blood vessel. It's got to be plugged or you'll bleed to death. Well, it turns out that it's an incredibly complicated process, that the flowchart for how blood clotting happens is amazing. But one small aspect of it is, a key aspect, is that the platelets, the blood platelets, have to be exposed to collagen, the stuff that, you know, makes our skin elastic and flexible and helps, you know, keep our body together, right? It needs exposure to collagen. Now, one of the questions we initially asked very early on, well, could platelets be deceived? Could platelets be fooled by a protein that looks like collagen but isn't collagen? Now, why would that be a problem? Well, if it were possible for platelets to make a mistake in identifying collagen, that could lead to unnecessary and unwanted clotting. And as which does happen. And as we well know, clotting that happens at the wrong time, in the wrong place, too much, can lead to death, right? You die from thrombosis and so on. Clotting that doesn't happen when it should happen, that doesn't happen in the right place, that doesn't happen at the right time, that doesn't happen quickly enough, you know, will also lead to death. You'll bleed to death. So clotting has to fit in a kind of mean, a kind of, as an Aristotelian kind of philosopher, and I can explain a bit about that, in a kind of middle way between the extremes, on the one hand, too much of the clotting and not enough of the clotting. And obviously, if collagen could, collagen-like proteins could deceive platelets into activating to form a clot when they shouldn't, that would be dangerous. So it would be good to know from a clinical point of view what kinds of protein might fool platelets into unnecessary clotting. It would be good to identify those, and it would be good then to kind of make sure that in drug manufacture and so on, we don't unintentionally introduce collagen-like proteins into our substances that could then...
And this is something that we don't fully understand yet?
Well, no, we don't fully understand. So in order to... Something that we haven't done, but that is kind of on our agenda, in order to get a sense for what kinds of collagen-like proteins could deceive platelets into making a mistake, you'd need to search protein databases for a start to find the requisite kind of similarities. And that takes a lot of time. We'd also have to pick out which among the different collagen-like proteins are the ones that are most likely to cause activation. And that requires certain in vitro experimentation. You'd need to get platelets on a... basically on a slide. I mean, I'm not a biologist. I'm sure my colleague John is would be writhing around now at the simplicity that I'm putting this with. But I mean, you need to get your platelets on a slide, and you need to expose them to a particular protein and see if they activate, how quickly they activate, and how much they activate, and so on. And so, you know, that those are experiments that are waiting to be done. And we are kind of, you know, inching our way towards aspects of this, but we're also working on a number of other things to do with blood. But certainly we think the biologists should be doing those kinds of experiments to see, is there a common thread here? I mean, it's not that the platelet responds to the whole collagen protein. It responds to parts of what's on the surface of the collagen protein. Because platelets, like all cells, have to be very selective in what they respond to. Because if they had to check out everything or identify everything, nothing would ever get done. Just think, if your antibodies had to do a full kind of a full ID on a particular virus before they activate, you'll be dead from the virus before the antibodies get into action. They have to respond to receptors on the surface of the virus, or they have to bind to certain very specific bits of the cell. Well, what are those? What are the ones? You know, on collagen, we know what they are, but can we find other proteins where there are similar kinds of assemblages of receptors that would also lead to activation? You'd need to do some serious protein database searching, and you'd need to do some actual in vitro experimentation. I think those are things that haven't been done as far as we know.
It seems intuitive. You know, if you want to find out what a system does, you see where it broke down and find out why it broke down and sort of reconstruct what the system is all about from there. So I had to ask David, why hasn't anybody thought of this before?
It's hard to know. I mean, one of the things, we published a paper in the Quarterly Review of Biology last year, which sort of tackled this kind of broader question a bit. Again, I don't want to misspeak. I don't want to, no one has ever done an experiment on whether a collagen-like protein can cause platelet activation. You know, I don't know of one. There may be out there, but I don't think it's the sort of thing which has been systematically investigated, put it that way. Mm-hmm. Certainly in our discussions, that seems to be what we've come up with. Now, a lot of biology these days is generated by, apart from pursuing grants, the sort of superficial thing is the need for grant money to pursue projects that are going to have a wow factor, a lot of appeal to granters, investigating clinical issues and things that can have a real world immediate kind of or short-term clinical impact. There's a lot of pressure there. There's a lot of big data, right? The advent of huge databases of proteins and molecules and different kind of AI and the ability to interrogate huge amounts of information is great. It's wonderful stuff because it gives you things that you couldn't possibly have got before. But our worry is that if you're led too much by big data and not enough by actual theory, including kind of basic philosophy, you can get a little bit scattered in your approach. You kind of just, someone's just come out with a huge protein database. Let's just run some checks on it to see what comes up if we're interested in X. Well, okay, that's all very well, but why are you doing that? What are you looking for? And often it's just, let's just see what comes up, and you can come up with all sorts of interesting ideas. But I guess as a philosopher, I like to think more systematically and a kind of more, let's go back to basics. Let's have some what do we know about biology? What do we think about how biological systems operate? How can we better understand living systems? And then let's go to the data and see what the data can tell us about what we think we need to investigate. So for us, you need to start with basic principles. And one of the key basic principles for us is this key philosophical term of normativity. Normativity refers to the fact that some things go right and some things go wrong. Some things go well and some things go badly. If I get sick, that's bad for me. I could, I'm in a bad way. I can't function properly. If I'm healthy, I'm in a good way. I can function and I can continue living. The same goes for all biological systems, right? They're either healthy, that without exception, they're either functioning well or they're functioning badly. They survive or they don't survive. They reproduce or they don't reproduce. They adapt to their environment or they don't adapt to their environment. The ones that don't adapt, are likely to die out. The ones that do adapt can progress and develop and move on to maybe even bigger and better things, right? As we humans are so good at doing. This is all normative. It's about how things go well and how things go badly. And the thing about mistakes is that mistakes are a normative idea. It's a normative concept. It's not just physics. Now, in physics, you don't get any of that, right? So in physics, there are mistakes, but they're not the same kind of thing. So in physics, you have physicists who make mistakes, right? So there are mistakes in physics hypotheses and theories and textbooks. There are mistakes made by physicists, but there are no mistakes in the actual objects that physicists study. No one would ever say an electron could make a mistake. You'd be laughed at. Protons, photons, electrons, atoms, molecules, they just do what they do according to the iron laws of physics. And even in quantum mechanics, right, where probabilities are involved, electrons don't make mistakes, protons don't make mistakes, but dogs make mistakes, wolves make mistakes, frogs make mistakes, antibodies can make mistakes.
One of the differences that I noticed while you were talking about physics and biology is that a lot of the biology experiments that you shared, so the frog and the dragonfly, for example, or the virus and the immune system, the agents, if I can call them that, have sort of opposing goals or opposing purposes in those examples. So the dragonfly wants to survive, but the frog wants to eat it. Characterizing these as mistakes, you are already supposing that there is a purpose and a goal to these things. Is that true?
That is, that's a really good point to focus on. So our project is part of this very big multi-million dollar ongoing John Templeton Foundation project called A Biological Purpose. Or it's actually, was the website's biological purpose, that the official title is Agency, Directionality, and Function. But it's all about biological purpose. It's all about goal-directedness in biology, purpose, functions, and all the things that go together with those. And there are teams, 24 teams all over the world working on different aspects, and we're working on mistakes. So mistakes we see as definitely requiring, presupposing, and being intimately connected with the idea of goal-directedness and purpose and function. So you're quite right. So that it's the insect, the dragonfly, wants to escape. So that's why it jumps away, because it sees the frog coming. It may not know it's a frog. It may not, it's hardwired to escape something jumping at it, predators, we don't know how dragonfly, we don't know what's going on inside the dragonfly brain. It's difficult to know, but, it knows to escape predators. So it's got its purpose. The frog's got its purpose. I've got my purpose studying the frog, etc., etc., etc. So all of biology is an intricate web of, as you say, conflicting and also complementary purposes. So, for example, the two birds that mate after birdsong attracts one to the other, share a complementary purpose of reproducing. So they're kind of on the same page, speak in terms of goal directedness. Human beings, when we cooperate with each other and do things together, where you're interviewing me or I'm talking to a student or someone's giving a lecture and I'm listening, we share a purpose. But when the purposes conflict, that's obviously conflict itself comes from conflicting purposes, goals and aims and so on. That's all fascinating. And part of what it is to understand goal-directedness is to come to terms with all of that. And I think it's not so much that mistake theory proves goal-directedness. It makes no sense without goal-directedness. Now, protons don't have goals in that sense. Electrons don't have goals in that sense. Now, you could say, well, they kind of have a goal. If you have a proton and you have an electron, they attract each other. Or if you have a proton and a proton, they repel each other. So they have goals. Why don't you say that one proton has a goal to escape the other proton, or one proton has a goal to attract the electron? Well, I think, calling it a goal is, I just don't think that helps. It doesn't help understand the difference. Call it whatever you like. It is true that according to the laws of physics, negative charge will attract a positive charge and so on. But when you get with living systems, it's really more than that. That's why normativity comes in, because the goals of living systems aren't just, the dragonfly goes here when it's in the presence of a frog going there. It's rather that the dragonfly is trying to escape. Anyone who says that the behavior of the dragonfly is just like the behavior of a billiard ball being hit by another billiard ball or a proton being repelled by a proton really doesn't understand living things. It's trying to escape a predator. The frog is trying to catch the prey. The bird is trying to attract a mate. The beaver wants to build a dam. Even though the beaver doesn't think, it doesn't have language, it doesn't conceptualize dam in any way like that, nevertheless, it has an inbuilt goal of producing a certain kind of structure to very precise specifications that has to serve a purpose for its continued flourishing and survival. And that's the normative aspect of goals.
So David thinks of biological entities as things that act with intention. These can be viruses, blood platelets, organisms, everything has some kind of intention. But because of their complex ecologies and evolutionary histories, it is not so straightforward to figure out when these things have made a mistake.
A frog is probably just playing the numbers, right? I will go after 15 things and out of that I'll get 2 and that's enough for my meal for the day. So do you think mistakes are kind of built into evolutionary systems in some way?
That's a great question. When we give our kind of formal definitions, we published a paper in the British Journal for the Philosophy of Science earlier this year, which is it's available online and you can have a look at that. It's called biological mistakes. We give a rigorous definition of what a biological mistake is. And one thing we make clear, we build into the definition, is that a mistake is relative to an environment and a set of circumstances. You can't just look at an organism doing X and say, well, that was a mistake, or that wasn't a mistake, except in very rare cases. I mean, you know, there are particularly isolated, you know, sort of more simplified cases, an organism that jumps off a cliff or something and goes splat, you know, that's a mistake. It's hard to know how that couldn't have been a mistake. But I mean, generally speaking, you know, organisms in their niches and their environments are involved in complicated interactions with a whole, with the members of the same species, members of other species, predator, prey, harsh environments, uncooperative environments, changes of temperature, changes of climate, changes of threats. So in order to know whether something is a mistake, you have to look at how the organism is situated in its environment, how it relates to its environment. So suppose typical nature documentary, you've got a lake somewhere in Africa, you've got a bunch of, flamingos wading around in the lake, and a lion pounces. The lion, well, doesn't seem to be going for any particular flamingo, it's just trying to catch a flamingo, right? So it just jumps into the lake, splashes, and all the flamingos scatter. Now there, presumably, say, oh, it's made a mistake, it hasn't caught one. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, you have to look at what it's trying to do. As you said, well, there could be a strategy here of a numbers game. Jump and hope that one of them, you're going to catch one of them. And that could be a perfectly good strategy, and which might work over the lifetime of the animal, but might not work on a particular occasion. So then you have kind of very subtle questions to ask about, well, has it made a mistake on that particular occasion? If it's implementing a strategy which works over the long term, maybe the lifetime of the animal, or maybe the lifetime of the whole species, you might be inclined to say it's not a mistake. So what we need to look at, really, is whether the action or the behavior of the animal concerned undermines its ability to function well, to flourish well, to, as we like to say, to act effectively in its environment.
Yeah, so it's not just, and this is important for someone listening to this, and maybe who thinks that if you think just about mistakes in biology, you're just thinking about diseases. It's not just diseases.
Right. So that brings up a really important question. There are some crucial concepts in the area of mistake theory which have to be distinguished from mistakes. So, yeah, originally you might think, well, mistakes, that's just getting sick. You know, it's a mistaken way to be or whatever. You know, take the difference between... I go out on the beach and the sun is shining, but there's a lot of cloud cover, and I don't really think it's going to be a problem if I stay out in the sun for too long because it looks pretty overcast. It's sunny, but not that bad. I turn out, I stay out too long and I get a bit burned. Have I made a mistake? Well, in the circumstances, given what I knew, given the environment, you know, you could say maybe you didn't make a mistake. But suppose I go out and I stare into the sun, you know, and I literally, and I used to do this as a kid, actually, and I regret doing it. You know, I've probably damaged my eyes forever. I don't know. But, you know, stare into the sun. So how long can I look at the sun for? Well, everyone will tell you you shouldn't do that. That's a mistake.
Yeah.
Don't stare directly into the sun. So there's a difference between things that kind of happen to you and things that you do. Now, you might say, so really, mistake theory is all about responsibility and fault, right? You're at fault. Mm. But animals don't have responsibility. They're not moral creatures. They don't, you don't blame the dog. It just forgot where it put the bone. And I would say, no, it's not about, we're not talking about moral responsibility. Yes, human beings can make moral mistakes. You know, I go up to a random stranger and whack them in the face. It's a bad thing to do, and it's a moral kind of mistake, right? I haven't got, my morality's not right if I think that's okay to do it. But nevertheless, all organisms that make mistakes must be capable of a certain kind of agency. They must be capable of either acting or not acting, not in the sense of like having free will. Maybe they just do what they do, but nevertheless, they act. And in different circumstances, they would have acted differently. So a mistake has to involve what we call an agential element. There has to be a doing. It's not just simply you got hit by a lightning bolt or a rock was dropped on you from a great height. That's bad, but it's not a mistake. It's only a mistake if you are somehow, as an agent, contributing through your behavior to the bad outcome.
So going back to the disease example, right? If a pathogen fools your immune system. The disease kind of happens to you, but your immune system has made a mistake.
Excellent.
Is that correct?
That's great. No, that's exactly what I would say. That what happened, you know, we don't like talking about levels in our team. We've got it. There's this big discussion in philosophy about biology about levels, you know, the molecular level and cellular level and the organismic level and the ecological level. Levels talk is a bit tricky, but I guess what I would say is that biology consists of systems within systems within systems in a kind of nested way, right? You know, you have atoms and molecules within, you know, organelles within cells, within groups of cells, within organs, within systems and subsystems, and all the way to the organism, and then the species and populations and ecosystems and what have you. So, you know, systems within systems. Now, it may be that if I'm just walking outside, minding my own business, and I get hit by a bout of influenza, you know, someone walks past me who's got the flu or COVID or whatever happens to be, and through nothing that I've done particularly badly, I've just caught the flu. Now, I have not made a mistake. I've been subject to a failure. You know, I've been attacked out from the outside by a pathogen. But if the pathogen then mimics the self and fools, gets around the immune system through deception, then the antibodies make the mistake, not me. So I can have things within me that are making mistakes, even though I'm not making a mistake. It's relative.
So you're really seeing this theory as having sort of very broad implications for many different fields of biology.
We think so, yeah. We do very much so. You know, sometimes we talk about it being almost like a universal kind of framework. Now, just to make clear, we're not saying that mistake theory replaces any other theory in biology that is out there and is doing good work. There are loads of theories about biology generally and about specific biological systems which are perfectly great. We're not trying to tread on anyone's toes. All we're saying is, hey guys, you know, if you're interested in coming up with new ideas for experimentation and thinking about biological systems in a maybe slightly different way that you hadn't thought of before, think about mistakes, think about mistake theory, think about how organisms get things wrong, how they get things right.
I find this idea quite interesting, to think of all biological systems, whether it is our immune system or ecosystems or, you know, even human beings, as just kind of bumbling about, doing things and then seeing if it works. And if it works, great, we survive, everything is good. If it doesn't, we die. And as human beings, you know, just because we have so much power over the planet and over other organisms, our mistakes can be quite catastrophic. But more about that in the next episode. That's all from this episode of the Purpose Podcast. The Purpose Podcast is brought to you by the Biological Purpose Project. To learn more about the Biological Purpose Project, you can visit biologicalpurpose.org. Thank you for listening.